Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the playwright Amy Hartman. Amy Hartman's first play, Animal Medicine, was a finalist at the 1997 Eugene O'Neill Theater Conference. Her play, The Chicken Snake, was selected for workshop by the Lincoln Center's Director Lab in 2005 and received a reading at the Manhattan Theater Club in March 2006. It is scheduled to premiere at the Playhouse Repertory Company in November 2007. Her new play, Mazel, deals with the true experiences of Eastern European Jewish survivors living in Pittsburgh. It will be playing November 9th through December 4th at the Jewish Theater of Pittsburgh. Hi, Amy. How you doing?
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Sure. It's good to have you. You're going to start reading from your new play, Mazel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, this is, I'm going to be reading with Robin Walsh, who is playing Pearl, my main character, in Mazel.
Hi.
Hi, Robin.
I can hold my father's past in my hands, but I can't read it. It's in Polish. He wrote this back there before he learned to speak English before I was born. When I was growing up, my father was distant. For 37 years, he didn't talk about anything. Sure, today he's a man who can charm the sting out of a honeybee. Everyone knows him. He's like a celebrity. But when he came to this country from Poland in 1949, he was alone and didn't have two dimes to rub together. He had traveled out of hell and into the American dream. He found a job at Tyson Metals, married an American girl, bought a house, a car, had a kid, and tried to forget the six Nazi death camps he survived.
Once upon a time, there was this boy, Martin, who was named after his grandfather. They lived in Germany, sure, outside the Black Forest. For as long as anyone could remember, his family owned a bakery with, you know, the tiny string of bells that hangs from the top of the door. So when someone comes in, you hear ting, 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 like that. Martin grew up under his grandfather's feet, behind the counter, sitting in the flour. His grandfather was an ordinary guy, hardworking, quiet, and he could all the time know exactly where to find his grandfather from smelling the warm bread and the deep trombone sound of his voice.
For people like my father, there's a hole where a past should be, pieces of him missing. You can't give away what's gone into hiding. He gave me his fear. No overnights, no weekend Jewish girls club, no dating. No exceptions. He had to know where I was at all times. This is how he loved me.
Sometimes in the middle of the afternoon, when only one or two ladies came in anyway, his grandfather would lock the front door. In the back room, the old man would reach under the rug and bring out the silver key. This key unlocked the secret drawer behind the drawer inside his desk. "Don't tell nobody," his grandfather said, pulling out the magic book of stories that was older than... forever. "Hansel and Gretel," the boy begged. "All right, but this is the last time," his grandfather laughed. "We'll get to the part where Hansel pokes the chicken bone out between the bars of the cage to fool the witch." And when they did, Martin's grandfather would lower his voice, pulling the boy closer and closer to him, and the boy felt safe.
There was no evidence of grandparents, uncles, aunts, no relatives, no talk of childhood memories or the place where my father came from. This notebook is the only trace of the boy he was. So I never really knew him. And so there were pieces of me that were missing, pieces just out of reach, written in a language I don't understand.
Years after that, the boy wasn't a boy anymore. He had grown into this. Me. My grandfather got very sick and never left his bed. I was holding his hand when he died. I was thinking how small the hand had shrunk, how brittle it was, like Hansel's chicken bone, fragile, like that. So after the funeral, I went to the bakery alone, found the silver key, opened the secret drawer, and found his Hansel and Gretel book, yeah. So when I opened it, I found between the pages what he had really been hiding in his bakery, yeah. That was the night the story of him ended, and I learned I didn't really know him at all.
Today my father spends a lot of time speaking in high schools, colleges, giving them his memories, but he didn't give them to me, never to me. I didn't realize how little I knew him until that night last February when I found what he was hiding in his house.
And this next piece is from one of the survivors in the play. I remember the sounds that night we were taken. Night falling around us, so tired from digging, my brother's breathing like a locomotive chasing sleep. Mama whispering in the farther room, pleading with Tata to leave. Not yet, not yet. His voice is raspy and low. The silence of Poland falling. It took one day. Then they come for us. It happens at 5 o'clock in the morning. Bang, bang, bang. Not waiting for an answer. Then Tata framed in our bedroom door, whispering loudly, "Come, boys, be quick. Get dressed. Hurry now. To the dining room. Don't be afraid." My mama's face ashen white, my sister's holding onto her legs, my older brother holding onto my younger brother. We hurry out into the street. It's cold. Schnell, schnell. Everyone we know being herded into the market square. The noise. I cover my ears. German shepherd dogs barking, snapping, children shrieking. My older brother too afraid to make a sound. The police laughing, our neighbors pointing. Jew, Jew. So the Germans know where to look if someone is hiding. What does a Jew look like? Remembering feels like a fist in my mouth, the throat closing up, the damp scent of steam and wood and mud and straw and fear. March, march! My older brother panting, his eyes darting, wildly looking around for an escape. Don't turn to the left or to the right. Falfuta, falfuta, schnell, falfuta, ude. Boot heels stomping on cobblestones, the blast of a gun. You are not human. Schnell, keep up or they shoot you. This is the noise of the world ending, of God disappearing, the ripping of skin holding skin as we are divided and separated, the hiss of the cattle car leaving me without them. Then, only the absence of sound.
You've just tuned in. You're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the playwright Amy Hartman, reading from her new play, Mazel. I want to ask you about this play, and it's based on Flares of Memories, edited by Anita Brostoff. And can you tell me the relationship to your play and Flares of Memories?
Sure. I had gotten a commission from the Holocaust Center. Dr. Edie Neve had called me, and it actually started with me playing the violin. Her husband is a violin teacher, and he was my violin teacher.
Oh, okay.
And so I was giving him some of my plays to read because I am a terrible violinist. So he had given, Dr. Neve some of my plays to read, and she liked them, and she came to see some performances of plays that, were mine, and she offered me the commission. And, it's, inspired by the book Flares of Memory that were, true accounts of children of the Holocaust, people who now live in Pittsburgh. And so I read the book a few times, and I picked one survivor, Jack Sitzimer. And I sort of had to find a story in all these stories. And so I created a story within a real story. So Jack Sitzimer is a real survivor, and I gave him a daughter, Pearl. And it's really about the relationship between fathers and daughters, I think. Fathers and children, really. And what we pass down to our children. So it's about Pearl and her father, Jack, and how she discovers his past.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to interview any survivors?
I interviewed quite a number of survivors. I spent 6 months. I have about 25 hours of interviewing Jack and his daughter and other children of Holocaust survivors, and I would say about 20 other survivors. And, so I spent a lot of time doing research and getting to know them, not just interviewing them, but trying to get to know them and be a part of the fabric of their life.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the choice to create a story within a story rather than using strictly autobiographical details?
Right. It was different, yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, because you always have to find a personal aspect to tell a story, to make it intimate, you know. And so I had to find parts of this thing that had nothing to do with me. I'm not Jewish, and it was something really outside of my own experience. But my father fought in World War II, and he fought hand-to-hand combat in Germany. And he never talked about it. He never talked about his experiences in the war. And so I understood that. I understood the emotional fabric of that. And I think that, you know, no matter what circumstances are, you know, we're, I tried to you know, get down to the raw emotion of that. Mm-hmm. But it was difficult, you know, because it's not my story. It's someone else's. And so a lot of it was just cutting me out of the story and sticking to the voices of these real people and not indulging myself in, mm-hmm. you know, my...
And another thing about me.
Right. Like, and here's more of my stuff.
Yeah, right. Trying to get their voice in my head.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's keep talking about that, but how about some more from Mazel?
Sure. This is another two survivors. Survivor 1 and Survivor 3, and this is really about the issue of food in the camps. I'm in Bergen-Belsen. I smell the biscotti and soup in line. I'm putting up my tin bowl, my only property besides a spoon. Will I be lucky enough to be somewhere in line when the capo reaches toward the bottom of the canteen where all the good stuff settles?
In the camp, to eat, you risk your life? Me and my buddy Sam decide one night to sneak out of the barracks while everyone is asleep and steal some potatoes.
The capo pours my daily ration, a ladle of creamy golden yellow mush, and a slice of bread. I am walking away carefully, not spilling even one drop of the mystery soup.
I know there is a ditch they keep the potatoes in, like a pyramid with layers of straw, then the dirt on top, and another layer of straw like that. It works like insulation. The moon is full, so there is enough light, and we dodge the sweeping spotlights until we are out of sight of them.
I long for just a taste. In the barrack, I sit down on the straw. My father is next to me. I start slowly, ever so slowly, taking it in spoon by spoon, not even swallowing right away.
We find the mound, and Sam plunges his bowl into the ground, and then I do the same. Furiously, we dig until we reach them. Sam hits the first potato and he gasps. We are stuffing 2, 3, 4 potatoes into our shirts.
To me, this tastes like tea biscuits soaked in water or milk. Nothing like this has ever happened before. And then my mind starts to race.
Suddenly, we feel the ground tremble and then the sound of boots on dirt coming closer.
How to get another portion? A boy could get killed for trying. An idea strikes, but I will have to sacrifice one spoonful.
We sprint up like rabbits, tearing through the darkness, running, running, not looking back.
I don't mention the plan to my father. I nonchalantly walk out of the barrack, scoop up a handful of mud, mix it with a spoonful of soup, smear the mixture over my jacket, and walk towards the capo. I don't dare go into the kitchen. The SS officer notices me. He says, "Hey, pig dog, what are you doing there?"
I hear the pop of the gunshot. I turn my head.
"Herr Oberführer, I fell and spilled my supper, and I've had nothing to eat." I show him my jacket to convince him. He looks at me. I hold my breath.
Sam is falling forward, and for just one moment our eyes meet, and I see the life in him run out.
He says, "Another serving, then. Go." With this, I am inside the kitchen, and the capo is pouring me another portion of biscotti and soup. It is a miracle.
I hug the potatoes tighter and run. I dodge the lights and look for a place to hide them, under the stilts holding up the barracks. Back into the barrack, quiet as a goose's feather swallowing air. I find a space between two others and lay down, draping my legs over someone else's. I fall asleep, thinking of the potatoes.
I am so hungry. My father is starving, too. I could eat, and he would never know the difference.
The next morning at Reveille, Sam lays on the ground. His eyes are wide and vacant with death. I wonder what they did with his potatoes. Will the Germans be eating them for dinner? Will I swallow one of Sam's stray peels in the dirty water after work?
When you are starving, you taste the soup just by looking at it. The tongue swells. Your body begins to digest before you bring it to your lips.
The next night I went out alone. If you had a potato at night and a slice of bread in the morning, You were a king.
Do I share my soup with my father? Do I eat it all by myself? The mind tells me to eat, but the heart... Sometimes. Somehow I share the soup with my father. Now I think maybe this is how we both survived. And this is... This is Martin, the German Actions for Reconciliation for Peace Worker in my play. He's describing something that happened to him in the 61C Cafe. Before you come for me tonight, I was in this coffee house, so many people. So we are sitting like sardines, yeah, so close. And I meet Anna. Yeah, Anna is, wow, so friendly. I see she likes me very much in the 61C Cafe. She was sitting also with a girl with blue hair and two overweight boys. They are all like me, 19, 20 years old. Hey, everyone, meet Martin. And then I'm puffing up like the cowboy, like John Wayne. We are all talking, and Anna asks me where I'm from. Oh, a little town in southwest Germany, Schomburg, I tell her. Next to the Black Forest, you know, cuckoo clocks. And she says, oh, Hansel and Gretel. Yeah, yeah, Hansel and Gretel, I say. And then she says, so Martin, you're a Nazi. But I don't think this is funny. I tell her, are you crazy, man? No way. But I spill my tea and she's standing now angry. Prove it, prove it, prove it, Nazi boy. Shake Roman's hand, because Roman is black. Shake it, everyone in one voice now. Someone shoves me, I stamp up, and I don't know what else to do, so I shake Roman's hand. Then I grab my backpack, but Anna catches me here like this, and she says, don't you want to be my Nazi? I am flustered. Can't you take that joke? She yells, you know, still laughing at me. I don't turn around. I stand outside in the snow, and I listen to all the people laughing at me inside until I see your car. I don't know that girl, but... still, she is in front of me.
You've just tuned in. You're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the playwright Amy Hartman. She's reading from her new play, Mazel, which will be playing November 9th to December 4th at the Jewish Theater of Pittsburgh. For tickets, you can call Pro Arts. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about, you know, some of the relationships that were formed when you said you were getting to know...
Mm-hmm.
some of the survivors,
mm-hmm.
and that you did more than interview them, but you came to know them.
Mm-hmm.
They became part of your life.
Yeah, I think because the subject matter is so tender, I really spent a lot of time with them. There's a woman named Esther Haas who is a survivor, and she was one of Magdalene's experiments and gynecological guinea pigs. And she taught me Hebrew lessons. And that's just how I got to know her, is I brought my Hebrew book to her once a week. And over a period of a couple of years, I've got to know her. And we became very close. And, you know, everything that's in the play, all the survivors who are in the play read the play, they read the drafts, and they tell me if something is too personal for me to keep in the play. But the really remarkable thing is they've never asked me to censor myself at all. They've never asked me to take anything out. The truth is very important to them. And so it's a very intimate play, I think, because of their bravery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I want to talk about the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is very important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk
about rough.
The politics of entering that truth, even if you've mm-hmm. had these relationships? Is that, in your mind, a writerly question, or is that go beyond that? Because, I mean, I'm sure you've heard people... who believed like no art after the Holocaust, no poetry after the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
There's some things that go beyond art,
mm-hmm.
and some kind of tragedies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they go straight to the human soul. It's you know, I was speaking with Jack the other day, and someone had asked him if telling his story helps him to heal from what happened to him. He survived 6 Nazi German death camps before the time he was 20. And he said, no, you know, you never heal. And so in America, we think of that sort of emotional, you know, our fences are so high that most of us, that when you see that sort of, or you experience that sort of horror, you know, that war presents, it's such a foreign experience for a lot of us that we don't realize that it's something that you never heal from, that you live with. And so the truth is very rough and very rugged. And but, you know, and it was very hard to hear over and over and over again. You know, I had I started to have nightmares when I was writing it. And, you know, but their experience was so profound that there was something underneath that horror. And so it's like an onion, you know, you really have to keep listening. And you start to realize, you start to hear other things as well and pick them out. And, you know, cause it's shocking. You have to get through the shock of hearing all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what enabled you to get past the trepidation? If you had some about entering the stories of others, was it your role as a playwright, or because this sounds like it became very human and very, real in your life?
Yeah, it was. It's been my entire life for 2 years. I think I don't think you get past it. You know, I think that what happens is that you you sort of, or well, I don't know what people do, but what I did was I kind of took these people. I tried to digest these people's stories, and I tried to honor their truth with as much dignity as I could find, or as much was there. And so it was really, so much of it had to do with me getting out of the way, and not doing anything, not imposing my voice on that voice, and letting that voice be, you know, clean and pure. Because I mean, the real black hole of this is pretension, you know, being too sentimental. And so I tried to really safeguard myself. And I have a dramaturg, Carlin Aquiline, who is the literary manager at the City Theater. And she's been just excellent in terms of that. And so she'll circle a line and say, this is Amy Hartman.
Get her out of there.
And it's like amputation.
Okay. Good. We have time for some more.
Oh, great. I'm going to have Robin read. This is a story of a survivor, too. She was in Auschwitz.
The Nazis were efficient. There was a gypsy camp within Auschwitz. There were 20,000 gypsies there and 10,000 Jewish girls in separate barracks. A terrible place. We have to get up at 2 a.m. for the Appell, the roll call. The Nazis come, and we stand in a line until 7, 8, or 9 o'clock in the morning. It is very cold. We have only rags on. We are freezing. Then when the sun comes up, it beats down on our shaved heads. I faint. The capo slaps my face. I come to. The dirt of his hand imprints my cheek. I turn, and I see the gypsy dresses whirling, their bright colored purple and maroon, yellow, red, waving in small circles. I envy these gypsy girls with their long, dark, wavy hair, their long dresses with 1,000 ruffles. To me, shaven, in rags, they are beautiful. And the noise, the singing and the arguing at all hours until Then one morning, it is so quiet, so still. I asked the capo, why are the gypsies so quiet? Where are they? She points up there. The gypsies are up in the crematorium. See them dancing? And she is laughing. And I am watching the smoke curling and twisting away from us. And I don't feel anything at all. Not even the cold. I am numb. All 20,000 gypsies gone. All of them gone in a single night. I think of nothing. Just this. How efficient the Nazis are.
And the next piece I'm going to read is by Survivor 3. Gusen 2 was liberated May 5th. That morning when we woke up, there was no one there and all the electricity had been shut off. We kept looking out the windows. We were afraid to leave the barrack until 4 American GIs found the camp. They weren't looking for it. No one knew we were there. Slowly, people started to leave. My buddy Arthur and me were too afraid to walk through the gate. On the third day, we crawled under the fence and walked by moonlight to the nearest city. We slept during the day. When we got to Linz, the curfew sirens were screaming, and this older woman, Mrs. Weber, opens her door telling us to come in or get shot. Turns out she's a nurse. She burns our striped rags to kill all the lice. It's been 4 years since I've worn underpants or taken a real shower. When I catch my reflection in the glass, I don't know that skeleton boy. I'm 71 pounds, Arthur is 75. All we can digest safely is clear soup, and now Mrs. Weber's haferflocken. Arthur lifts his hands up to the rolled oats. Haferflocken again, what a delight! And we laugh and laugh, even though it's not that funny. I eat out of my bowl I bring from the camp. It never leaves my sight. I tie this string through the hole, and I wrap the string around my waist. Once, someone stole mine, so I stole someone else's. The bowl is your life. Mrs. Weber says that I should remember so I can tell the world what happened, but it's all upside down now. The soft bed, the kindness. I can't make sense of the bed. So I sleep next to it on the floor where I can't fall. Arthur sleeps in the corner where no one can shoot him. He wakes up when he hears Mrs. Weber downstairs doing the dishes. In the light, he tries to get us to laugh, but in the dark, I know he wonders if we're safe. I've gained 5 pounds, Arthur 7 still. Arthur stands next to her, anxiously holding the dish towel, making sure she isn't calling the SS to come take us away again.
The writing of Amy Hartman. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Hartman's new play, Mazel, will be playing November 9th to December 4th at the Jewish Theater of Pittsburgh. For tickets, call Pro Arts. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.